consumption is about pleasure, bodies, and identities as much as about individual choice or purchasing power. And fashion was at the center of the transformations of metropolitan consumption in many societies at many times, but perhaps nowhere more so than in London of these so-called swinging 60s. I should say I'm particularly pleased, and I was saying to Chris earlier, that for once we have an extremely well-dressed audience. To help us understand how such cultural watersheds like the 60s come into being and about the relationship between consumers and designers, fashion and urban culture, I'm delighted to introduce this evening my colleague in the Cultures of Consumption program, Professor Chris Brewer. Chris is currently Professor of Historical and Cultural Studies at London College of Fashion, but very soon will take up a new post as Deputy Head of Research at the Victoria and Albert Museum. As many of you know, Chris has been at the forefront of the new fashion history and has written widely on fashion and male consumers in particular. With David Gilbert, he is directing a project in the Cultures of Consumption program called Shopping Roots in Postwar London. And if you're eager to find out more, do take the opportunity at the reception to talk to Chris or visit our webpage, or indeed look at his... his lovely new book, Fashioning London. Some copies are also on display outside, and I highly recommend it to you having read it. After the lecture, discussion will be kicked off by two very special commentators, Elizabeth Wilson, an expert on fashion and cultural studies, and Peter York, cultural commentator and founder of the consultancy SRU. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Brewer.
Okay, could have the first slide up, please. There we go. In 1973, the London Museum, now the Museum of London, held an exhibition celebrating the achievements of the womenswear designer Mary Quant. And more than any other figure associated with the previous decade, Quant and her work had come to represent a moment when the city rediscovered its confidence. Through a playful and highly significant engagement with processes of conspicuous consumption, personal enlightenment, and sexual revolution, the designer and her generation were credited with overturning pre-war strictures of control, consensus, and restraint in dress and social life. Yet by the early 1970s, the associated idea of swinging London had lost those connotations of excitement and new possibilities which had marked its heyday. In the face of economic uncertainties, international turbulence, and social unrest, the glow attributed to the recent past was dismissed by many pundits as little more than the surface polish of media hype, its effects dulled by a pervading sense of distaste and collective guilt. The exhibition took no such stance. It preferred instead to document the positive changes which the events of the 60s had effected on the material and cultural landscape of the capital. This bracketing of clothing design with other examples of social flux was an innovative step for the curation of fashion. And it's notable that the accompanying catalogue essay paid little attention to the output of Quant herself, preferring instead to present a contextual montage of architectural, theatrical, journalistic, and folkloric scenes, which paid homage to the progressive tenor of the times. As John Hayes, the museum director, stated, no exhibition which did full justice to Quant's achievement could fail to be about London life as well as about fashion. It seemed fitting, on the eve of our translation to a modern building, that our last exhibition at Kensington should be about contemporary living. And following in this vein, it's not the intention of this lecture simply to rehearse those debates that have since raged between left and right concerning the moral and political legacy of the period. The emphasis here will instead centre on exploring the relationship between those glossy images of a rejuvenated city which have defined our subsequent understanding of the epoch as a cultural watershed, and the connections, real and imagined, which were set up between designers, entrepreneurs, writers and consumers, particularly female consumers, which inspired and furthered such representations. For this confluence arguably rerouted the course of London fashion and the articulation of fashionable identities in unprecedented ways. So through this objective, the mapping out of a famously spectacular moment of urban consumerism, I am of course falling back on methods of critiquing and accounting for consumption that reflect my own training and subsequent employment as a cultural historian working within the perhaps atypical context of the art school and now the museum sector. And it may be worth thinking about this for just a few moments, for what follows differs in some respects, both from the preceding lectures in this series, whose authors have largely been associated with university-based humanities and social science disciplines, and from the general direction of debates around consumption as they've occurred in the academy over the past 20 years or so. In short, I find myself caught, a little uncomfortably perhaps, between a well-established sociological and cultural studies literature on consumption, which has often drawn on the example of fashion or fashionable items to illustrate the ways in which social identities have been constructed through the promises and constraints of commodity culture, and a more recent call by historians, especially, for studies of consumerism that resist these considerations of individualized acts of appropriation and negotiation in favor of accounts that stress the importance of broader ethical and economic contexts. An examination, in Matthew Hilton's words, of the political systems that place limits on such consuming actions, or the moralities of consumption that tie consumers to wider practices of belief. Now, fashion as a category is so far conspicuously absent from this latter turn towards what we might call a political economy of needs and desires, with its emphasis on citizens and institutions. But this is perhaps to be expected as part of a scholarly reorientation away from humanist explorations of the social life of things towards what Hilton posits as an ideological effort to locate consumption as a third political force. Now, I can appreciate the challenge set by these wider developments, yet I have to accept that I'm slightly out of step with their muscular ambitions. I fall back on what some may consider to be an outdated or reactionary concern with issues of style and the materiality of consumption. And this is because my professional and pedagogic allegiances demand it, for the art school and the Decorative Arts Museum are in some ways still theatres for the spectacular enactment of a style economy, where the products of consumer cultures form the basis for lyrical or memorialising interpretations, that are in any case no less ideological for all that. And more importantly, I'm not convinced that the physical landscape of consumer culture has been so comprehensively mapped in the relevant historical literatures that we can afford to assume that its haptic textures, its aesthetic values, and its visual properties are of themselves lacking in complexity or effectiveness, particularly where clothing is concerned. So in tracing out the coordinates of Swinging London and its new presentation of the young female consumer, my aim is not simply to celebrate the vibrancy of consumerist imagery in the period, but to demonstrate how historical processes such as these have produced powerful myths and stereotypes, which have informed our very understanding of contemporary cultures of consumption and moulded the character of post-war British fashion. So back to Quant. Unlike several of the hagiographic reviews of the period which followed, the Quant exhibition was careful to set its chronological boundaries outside of the measure implied by the duration of a standard decade. Though the notion of swinging London has come to be recognised as a defining theme of the 60s, many of the influences which informed its hegemony were in place by 55. This was the year in which Quant opened her first boutique on the King's Road, amidst a sea change in social attitudes and consuming practices which were to be formally identified by Colin McInnes, amongst others, by 1959. For example, in an article for the journal 20th Century, the novelist and keen observer of London's popular cultures cited the comments of Nancy Mitford, who on a recent visit to London had declared that working class girls and boys are incomparably smarter than the others. Compare the publics in Oxford Street and Bond Street, of now and of however far back your memory goes, and the present superiority of Oxford Street is startling. You will also observe there, as in any proletarian district of the capital, the lavish, colourful eruption of gay stores selling separates to the girls and sharp schmutter to the kids, shining, enticing shops like candy floss. But the transformation of the working class to power and relative affluence means that these styles are no longer working class at all. Now, though Chelsea in 1955 still bore traces of an artisanal past, its bohemian credentials disqualified it from any claim to be properly proletarian, in the sense that the more accessible Oxford Street was. And Quant's new shop, named Bazaar, a title itself replete with associations of the exotic souk and notions of the extreme or the unusual, charged prices that were out of reach of the average working class pocket. However, the broad direction of her assault on received and genteel ideas about fashion were clearly in tune with Mitford's suggestion of a more democratic turn in the evolution of English style. Beyond this, the spirit of her project was certainly rooted in a childlike abandonment to ephemerality, novelty, and fun, summarized in Mitford's perceptive use of the term candy floss. Quant's autobiography demonstrates how the deliberately naive and classless appeal of her brand was underpinned from the outset by an acute understanding of the commercial potential residing in Chelsea's shifting social and creative milieu. Her business manager, Archie McNair, though a lawyer by training, ran a photographic studio in the King's Road and sought to persuade her husband, Alexander Plunkett Green, to back a neighbouring coffee bar venture. McNair's hunch that the rich and well-connected clientele of his photography business would form a niche market for further lifestyle outlets proved to be prescient. And it was on this basis that Quant and Plunkett Green entered into the retail trade. Self-consciously extricating herself from any accusations of exclusivity or elitism, Quant enumerated her co-revolutionaries and future clients as painters, photographers, architects, writers, socialites, actors, conmen, and superior tarts. There were racing drivers, gamblers, TV producers, and advertising men. But somehow everyone in Chelsea, she says, was that much more go-ahead. Recalling her school days in Chelsea during the 1950s, the publisher Alexandra Pringle offered a less spectacular version of the King's Road and its inhabitants as they existed before these changes. She says, with its tall plane trees, squares of white-fronted houses, and red-coated pensioners, the district offered the traditional London vistas that would continue to form an important backdrop and counterpoint to a coming fashionable modernity. But in its range of amenities and retail outlets, the local landscape clearly belonged to a previous and more provincial era. Pringle remembers the grocer where there were glass-topped biscuit tins, the draper's, Woolworths with its counters piled high with sweets, and sedate expeditions to the Cardoma Coffee House following missions to Peter Jones for dress patterns or fabrics. But behind this respectable facade of familial cosiness, Chelsea also boasted a reputation for looseness. And this was earned largely through its long-standing provision of cheap studios and bedsits, which were essential for the survival of artists, theatricals, and other low-earning but socially ambitious creative types who had crowded into the district since the mid-19th century. Furthermore, attendant myths of debauchery and the availability of stylishly shabby accommodation proved attractive to later generations of trust-funded dropouts from neighbouring Belgravia. So the live-and-let-live ambience of Quant's newfound bohemia was central to the success of Bazaar in several ways. In his notes on home, published in Len Dayton's celebrated London dossier of 1967, Nick Tomlin distinguishes between the left-wing Hampstead coterie established by Jewish intellectuals in the 30s, and the more materialistic concerns of these post-war Chelsea types, who gathered, he says, in coffee bars and boutiques rather than café clatches or comrades' demos. Setting themselves against the constraints of austerity and the collectivizing tendencies of a nascent welfare state, they were, in his words, anarchists rather than communists. Political revolution and a concern with the social good were therefore less important to Quant's new patrons than the freedom to express their sense of individuality without censure. As Tomalin rather dismissively put it, they fled from Tunbridge Wells, Wilton House, or Alice Springs, rather than Auschwitz. The tyrant they defied was Daddy, not Hitler. Now, such priorities were closely met by Quant's finely judged stylizations of art student outrage. Jazz musician and raconteur George Melly was well aware of this when he attributed her genius to her daring, in his words, to throw a custard pie in the face of every rule of what, up until then, had constituted British fashion. Generational rebellion certainly fueled Quant's drive to create, but this was also inflected by a rather disingenuous belief in the irrelevancy of the class system, which disregarded the privileged backgrounds of most of her peers and clients, and an openness to the energy of the urban life around her. She rationalized her own success through her insistence that the secret of successful designing is to anticipate changes of mood before they happen. "I get new ideas all the time," she assured Jonathan Aitken as he chronicled the activities of the new youth entrepreneurs in London in 1967. "Going to nightclubs, seeing colours in the streets, it's a sort of flair within me. I'll keep in all right." Such tenacity had bought significant press recognition, positioning Quant as a fashion pioneer and setting a template for younger acolytes. Bridget Keenan of the Daily Express recalled that suddenly someone had invented a style of dressing which we realised we'd been wanting for ages. Comfortable, simple, no waists, good colours, and simple fabrics. It gave anyone wearing them a sense of identity with youth and adventure and brightness. No wonder the young journalists raved. Yet this official line rather obscured the haphazard nature in which Bazaar established itself on the Chelsea scene. Quant's wide-eyed enthusiasm for the project almost seemed to will its existence in the face of planning problems, building subsidence, complaints from the Chelsea Society regarding her architectural vandalism, and an attitude to stock control and supply that was disorganized in the extreme. Early items in the shop were, for example, famously constructed from fabric bought expensively at Harrods and made up unsystematically by Quant on a sewing machine in her flat. Such cheerful amateurism succeeded in spite of itself, became part of the myth, and imprinted a brand identity that seemed to grow organically out of the local culture. From such shaky foundations, Bazaar gradually became a national and then an international institution, presenting a prototype of chaotic creativity underpinned by a steely acumen that by 1964 was being replicated across the capital and further afield. Quant was adamant about the very visible role the shop would play in the life of the community, claiming that "we wanted Bazaar to become a sort of Chelsea establishment." This strong street presence was partly achieved through window displays that prioritised visual impact over the necessity to make sales. The boutique window as pop art installation was to become a familiar feature of the iconography of swinging London. But in the late 50s, Bazaar was already offering such surrealist interventions as figures in bathing suits with madly wide stripes, all strumming away on white musical instruments with bald heads and wearing round goggle sunspecs, which, as Quant says, were incredibly new. And in knowing homage to the figure of the 19th century Parisian dandy, one mannequin was beautifully dressed and leading this lobster on a gold chain. And in a further bracketing of nostalgic retro-referencing with a brazen avant-gardism that suited the Chelsea mood, Quant hired beautiful girls to act as sandwich men. These girls, elegantly dressed and looking tremendously chic, again in Quant's words, walked in the gutter along the King's Road and Brompton Road, carrying the traditional type of sandwich boards with the announcement, "Come to Bazaar, Mad Reductions," printed in beautiful old playbill type. They were, in Quant's words, a sensation. Now, Alexandra Pringle and her generation were clearly thrilled by such innovations, and she recalled utilising the entire repertoire of swinging signifiers that by the mid-60s, she says, local residents stared and pointed as young women catwalked up and down. They wore big floppy hats, skinny-ribbed sweaters, keyhole dresses, wide hipster belts, and I believed paper knickers. They had white lipstick lips and thick black eyeliner, hair cut at alarming angles, op-art earrings, and ankle-length white boots. They wore citron-coloured trouser suits and skirts that seemed daily shorter. They rode on miniature motorbikes. They had confidence, and it seemed no parents. Such exotic figments of memory may well have given the impression of hailing from nowhere, but Quant acknowledged the increasing role played by the media in nurturing and circulating what had now become the stereotype of the Chelsea girl, her appearance and attitudes based to a large extent on the ethos pervaded by Bazaar. Chelsea, she claimed, ceased to be a small part of London. It became international. Its name interpreted a way of living and a way of dressing, far more than a geographical area. Pulp novels such as Paul Denver's Black Stockings for Chelsea of 1963 reveled in this sartorial shorthand for permissiveness, providing lurid images of parties where, I quote, the first floor bulged with beatniks and jumped with jazz, West Indian percussion and the socked-out beat of rock and roll. The party was getting hotter by the second. The second floor landing was jammed with girls in tight blouses, wide skirts and knee-length cavalry boots. A dishevelled girl who an hour ago had looked like something out of a fashion supplement was hammering frantically on a bathroom door. Nobody was giving a damn. In the New York Herald Tribune, John Crosby gave the Chelsea girl a more glamorous, if still reactionary, interpretation, suggesting that he would like to export the whole Chelsea girl with her life is fabulous philosophy to America, to spread the word that being a girl is a much more rewarding occupation than being a lady senator. In effect, the image of the Chelsea girl, leather-booted and black-stockinged, presented a robust challenge to the sexual and social status quo. And Quant found herself held responsible for this by several commentators, who variously described her look as dishy, grotty, geary, kinky, mod, and all the rest of it. Yet even the publicity-hungry founder of Bazaar knew that she could not claim all the credit, admitting that, in fact, no one designer is ever responsible for such a revolution. Those in the mainstream British fashion industry, which was concurrently reorganising itself at the heart of a revitalised post-war manufacturing economy, were indeed sceptical about her influence. A prominent couturier stated that, although I think she is witty and some of her designs quite original, she has lowered the standard of mass-produced clothes, both from the point of view of making and from the point of view of graciousness. Others were even more vitriolic in their assessments. A fabric designer imagined that she must be rather masculine as a person, quite kinky, while a vendeur suggested that the harshness and coarseness of her clothes bring out nasty reactions in men. Much of this antipathy can be put down to the innate competitiveness of the sector. For example, the owner of a madam shop, the genteel ancestor of the boutique, clearly envied Quant her youthful market, arguing that she is a success because she is grotesque without taste. The kids have a vast amount of money, and the more grotesque a garment, the more they like it. Yet, regardless of its underlying causes, the ferocity of the media and industry backlash clearly revealed the power to shock and provoke that resided in the Chelsea look. At an organisational level, Quant's success in promoting her vision was also reliant on a broader restructuring of London's supply chains and publicity networks, which remain obscured in her own account. And this process had been initiated in 1950 when eight major British wholesalers came together behind the leadership of Leslie Carr Jones to form the London Model House Group. The group looked to the robust American fashion scene for inspiration, seeing in the corporate efficiency of Seventh Avenue's clothing giants a more appropriate model for modernization than the patrician elitism of the existing incorporated society of London fashion designers. By 1955, the Model House Group was itself in the throes of reorganization, building on a new sense of prestige to attract further members and capitalize on the arising publicity. The emerging Fashion House Group of London put its energies into arranging promotional events such as the twice-yearly London Fashion Weeks. And these were launched in 1958 under the chairmanship of Moss Murray with an unprecedented budget of £40,000 a year. Buyers and department store executives in Europe, the United States and the Commonwealth were encouraged to attend, and by 1963 the shows were being exported to Paris. In an echo of the Beatles tour, the itinerary was extended to North America in 1966, when, as Murray recalled, we sailed on the Queen Elizabeth with a party of 18 model girls, manufacturers, and 12 top British journalists. We were a wow. It simply wasn't done for a big store not to have British fashions. The group subsequently fractured along the fault lines of design, manufacture, and marketing. Young designers eager for autonomy set up the Association of Fashion Designers, and the established trade oriented itself towards the government-sponsored Clothing Export Council, following the lobbying of the Board of Trade by the high street stalwart Aquascutum. However, despite their decline in influence, the managerial initiatives set up by London wholesalers and suppliers in the late 50s were integral to the success and the profile of the Chelsea style. Indeed, it could be argued that they supported a brief 20-year interlude of unchallenged productivity in the history of British fashion that was not marred by the more familiar story of falling orders and bankruptcies. Michael Whittaker, who managed the shows for the London Fashion House Group in the mid-60s, was adamant that, high as we've got in the business, there would be no Mary Quant or any of the others like her without the original promotions of the Fashion House Group of London. And Quant's lucrative forays into the American market, she entered into a creative partnerships with New York-based JCPenney in 1962 and Butterwick and Puritan Fashions in 64, and her British-based wholesaling arm, the Ginger Group, an item of which you see here, established in 63, certainly shared more closely in the rhetoric of international corporatism espoused by technocrats like Carr, Jones and Murray, than in any effete sense of bohemian creativity as symbolized by the chaotic surfaces of the King's Road. It was, in fact, a combination of commercial know-how and the ability to promote her vision of King's Road permissiveness more widely through licensing deals that secured Quant's place at the forefront of the London fashion scene. And the direct inspiration for this came partly from McNair, who, on realizing that the manufacturing side of the business was draining profits, advised Quant to concentrate on designs which could be sold to international buyers in the form of aspirational products, including cosmetics and hosiery. McNair's motto became, "Money is the applause. If you do something well, if you make dresses people want, money is the applause." The future impact of this shift away from a Fordist understanding of clothing production towards an interest in anticipating and meeting consumer desires was evoked by journalist Roma Fairley, who in 1969 asked her readers to, in her words, picture a huge warehouse in a dreary warehouse district. There is a steady drenching drizzle which has replaced the old pea super as London's speciality. Outside is an advertisement for staff. Inside, beyond the grubby inquiries window, you catch your breath at what seems a huge, splendid wardrobe for an enormous harem. Fairley was describing the day-to-day realities of mass manufacturing fashion business at a time of transition, a time when these two cultures of supply-led production lines and the inspired modernity of consumer-led design came together. The dreary warehouse represented a post-war world of predictable monotony, interspersed with spectacular flashes of ephemeral colour. And this was all very different from the rarefied notion of creativity and craftsmanship associated with conservative models of fashion, such as that promoted by the Incorporated Society, that had dominated London's elite clothing economy since the 40s and traced its roots back to the court dressmaking traditions of the 1880s. Yet these opposing systems shared a certain energy. As Fairley observed, a wholesale collection is just as electrifying as couture, but there is no creative hysteria, just the hard-selling reproductions digested and formulated into the firm's price range. These dual prerogatives of initiating novel styles and careful planning according to market segmentation may well have given rise to an unprecedented degree of schizophrenia and creative diversification. The director of High Street Multiple Wallace revealed as much to Fairley when, in a big light room with hundreds of sketches on the walls, he waved an arm indicating the swinging look for Chelsea, Jolie Madame for Knightsbridge, mainstream of Wallace clothes for the rest of the country. But schizophrenic or not, commentators including George Melly acknowledged the unique manner in which Quant had reconciled such contradictions to great effect in her hybrid assault on complacency in all its forms. He says, Quant chucked ladylike accessories into the dustbin, recognised the irrelevancy of looking like a virgin, took into account that pavements and restaurants were not muddy hunting fields, nor partisan dances the antechambers of morgues. Innocent and tough, she attacked the whole rigid structure of the rag trade and won hands down and skirts up. So I like to move on to think a little more about the customers, about consumption and the figure of the female customer. Melly suggested that Quant's victory was a cultural and a material one. He claims that bizarre was a battle cry, a symbol of the new sophistication, and above all, news. It was the one true pop manifestation between rock and the Beatles. And nowhere was this more visible than on the streets of London themselves, especially those in Chelsea. Though from 1957, the emphasis of the Quant business had shifted up market to Knightsbridge, where a new store was opened, and into the international market. But the impact of its legacy on the King's Road was nevertheless profound. Vidal Sassoon, the celebrity hairdresser who was so instrumental in fixing Quant's image on the public consciousness, was adamant that its place was at the heart of those physical and psychological changes affecting London life during this period. I always said that the King's Road was Mary's atelier. It was one marvellous show. You could go to the King's Road, outside Mary Quant's, and there you had the young people. It was wonderful. Certainly by the mid-60s, the particular pop chemistry of Bazaar was being replicated with gusto across the metropolis. Jonathan Aitken, identifying with a certain patrician aloofness, the emerging boutique ideal as a small shop of flamboyant atmosphere, specializing in original and colorful clothes, usually at low prices, estimated that there were 2,000 of them in Greater London by 1967. Yet to some contemporary commentators, it seemed that London had fallen victim to a hollow consumerist spell. In June 1966, Anthony Lewis of the New York Times had reported that the atmosphere in the capital can be almost eerie in its quality of relentless frivolity. There can rarely have been a greater contrast between a country's objective situation and the mood of its people. For Christopher Booker, the idea of swinging Chelsea had become a Frankenstein's monster. In his words, fallen to a glittering, commercialized invasion dominated by large fashion chains and other external interests. And it was somehow symptomatic that by the summer of 1969, Bazaar had been sold to become a chemist shop. Already it was itself the symbol of a Chelsea that was almost gone. Booker goes on to suggest that Londoners came to read their city and its economic and social development through the prism of public relations and media rhetoric, rather than by trusting the less spectacular evidence of their own eyes. This is not to imply that the material environment of London had remained unaltered during these years, for Booker paints a vivid picture of the changed landscape which awaited a time traveller of 1955, transported forward into the city of 1965. He says he would have been struck by the change in the appearance of the young. Nothing would have surprised him more than the exhibitionistic violence with which these fashions grabbed at the attention. the contrast, the jangling colours, the hard glossiness, the show of thigh, curiously impersonal, like the expressionless stare that so often went with them, or the throwaway generic terms, birds or dollies, that were used to describe their wearers. Our visitor would have found the same visual violence everywhere, in the ubiquitous neon lighting, on shop fronts, on advertisements, in the more garishly decorated restaurants. If he had opened a fashion magazine, he would have been amazed by the blank, harsh photography and the awkward, even ugly contortions of the models. And if he ventured into one of the discotheques, the sensations of a strange, alienating harshness would have struck him more forcefully than ever. But the speed with which such change was being interpreted and fed back to its metropolitan audience by the machinery of an overactive press left little time for impartial assessment or critical reflection. Lending credence to the theoretical suppositions of such contemporary luminaries as Guy Debord and Marshall McLuhan, that style was superseding substance in a logical conclusion to the project of consumer capitalism. The famous issue of Time magazine, which appeared on April the 15th, 1966, is a key example of this myth-making process. It was the culmination of a series of articles which had exercised a normally solipsistic American press since the American journalist John Crosby had submitted a piece titled London, the Most Exciting City, to the British Daily Telegraph colour supplement a year before. The emphasis here was on eroticism. Crosby described a kaleidoscope of young English girls who were appreciative, sharp-tongued, and glowingly alive, who walk like huntresses, like Diana's, and who take to sex as if it's candy and it's delicious. This sexual element was also a factor which informed the commissioning of the Time assignment. Andrea Adam, who was on the staff of the magazine at the time, remembers that London was special. It had a kind of mystique. But what prompted the bloody cover story was not a fascination with a sociocultural phenomenon. It was the fascination amongst the senior editors for miniskirts. Any opportunity to put legs, tits, or bums in the magazine, and they would do it. Underlying motivations accepted, the April edition also offered an effective shorthand version of change and innovation that would come to stand in for the more nuanced material experiences which the city had to offer. This was a generalizing approach which carried powerful consequences for London's subsequent development as a world fashion center, whose importance to the global circulation of style was symbolic rather than economic. Preempting Booker, the publisher's letter, which introduced Time's swinging edition, also made great play of the physical and cultural changes which had affected the capital since the 50s. It related how on a previous visit, one of the editors looked at the bomb sites and visited the Tower of London, where she remembers having a dreary serving of watery mashed potatoes and Brussels sprouts. Undeterred, the same journalist had come again in 1965 to find a better England. It was L'Etoile and Ad Lib and the Trattorias in Soho and a place on the King's Road where she could buy a pair of bell-bottom slacks by Fole and Tuffin that made her something of a trendsetter back home in New York. Inspired by these experiences, the magazine had commissioned 7 staff writers in their London bureau and 5 American and British photographers to indulge in what they called 4 days of the most concentrated swinging that any group of individuals has ever enjoyed or suffered. And the article itself adopted the format of a storyboard for an imaginary film constituting 5 varying London scenes. These included an aristocratic evening with the son of a peer in Berkeley Square, starting at Jack Aspinall's Claremont Club and ending in Annabelle's nightclub, a Saturday afternoon shopping in Chelsea and the Portobello Road, taking in the Guys and Dolls coffee bar in the King's Road in the company of Mick Jagger, Kathy McGowan, and an anonymous teenager in a black and yellow PVC miniskirt, a concurrent Chelsea launch party in La Reve restaurant with Terence Stamp, Gene Shrimpton, Michael Caine, Vidal Sassoon, David Bailey, and Doug Haywood, where the conversation centred on the evils of apartheid and the current form of Chelsea football team, and an early evening cocktail party at Robert Fraser's Mayfair Gallery, attended by socialite Jane Ormsby Gore in a red Edwardian jacket, ruffled lace blouse, and skin-tight black bell-bottoms, designer Pauline Fordham in a silver coat and starlet Sue Kingsford in a two-piece pink trouser suit, which revealed her naked waist. The final scene focused on dinner with Marlon Brando, Roddy McDowall, Terry Southern, Francois Sagan, Barbara Streisand, Margot Fonteyn, and Warren Beatty in the Kensington house owned by Hollywood star Leslie Caron. After an excellent meal of chicken, claret, and chablis, these international jet setters danced till dawn. It sounds like an exhausting day. Readers of Time were slow to recognise the satirical flavour of the article, and the letters page of the magazine was home to an earnest debate on its merits and veracity over the next few issues. Correspondents likened Swinging London to the amoral city of Thackeray's Vanity Fair. One argued that's a hell of a test by which to measure a city's greatness, its ability to appeal to the moronic fringe, the smart alecks, and the social climbers. He substituted an alternative vista of mist along the river, the cries of the street markets, and the smell of old books, in a bid to reclaim the capital's patrician self-respect. Another suggested that the Star Renaissance held as much promise as rumours of the returning health of Britain's manufacturing base, stating that you have managed to look decadence in the face without seeing it. All the turned-on young men and women will burn out as quickly as a light bulb of British manufacture. And the following month, letter writers were still contesting the worth of the article, with two Londoners representing opposite views. A young woman enthused that, as a dolly from the scene, I say cheers for your gear article on the swinging switched-on city of London and boo to all the American geese who call it humbug. Her counterpart complained that visitors still find the same old dingy streets and grimy restaurants. Girls, except for women street cleaners, do not wear plastic suits. Carnaby Street is not a new phenomenon. It has catered to the chorus boy type for years. Now, besides stoking the growing frustration expressed by contemporary readers with the apparent superficiality of journalistic analyses of London's transformation, the April issue also set in motion a succession of diatribes aimed at the hollow excess of the new fashionable elite. In 1970, John Lennon famously told Rolling Stone magazine that the class system and the whole bullshit bourgeois scene is exactly the same, except that there are a lot of middle-class kids with long hair walking around London in trendy clothes. Nothing happened except that we all dressed up. In the same year, Bernard Levin railed against a decadent colour supplement sensibility, an increase in the artificial, the pre-packed, and a world in which the harmless word trend suddenly took on new meanings, as the practitioners of this kind of turnover worship began to hunt more and more frantically for the latest jewel with which to tempt the increasingly jaded palates of their readers. In his much later survey of British film in the 60s, Geoffrey Richards takes a similarly condemnatory view of the apolitical and hedonistic qualities of the swinging London bubble. He bemoans the fact that cinema in the period had been mainly London-centred, male-centred, style-centred, fatally self-indulgent. The issues of class, race, region and gender had taken second place to the exaltation of a classless consumerist self. Interestingly, in order to support his thesis, he cites the ideas of sociologist Bernice Martin, who proposed that the tenets of Romanticism were manifest in the swinging phenomenon. She says, Romanticism seeks to destroy boundaries, reject conventions, undermine structures, and universalize the descent into the abyss and the ascent into the infinite. Its matrix is material prosperity that releases people from the immediate disciplines of survival and that concentrates their attention on their expressive needs, self-discovery, self-fulfillment, experience, and sensation. Now, Martin's perhaps questionable analysis is arguably, however, less value-laden than the negative verdicts of Lennon, Levin, Richards, and all the rest. Indeed, its optimistic eliding of an avant-gardism with the expressive potential of consumer culture opens up some space for a final consideration in my conclusion of the positive benefits associated with perhaps that most persistent of London's swinging London stereotypes, the dolly bird. The new West End landscape of boutiques and discotheques provided an arena in which some young women certainly found the freedom to, in Martin's word, destroy boundaries, reject conventions, and undermine structures. And though this may have appeared undisciplined and threatening to an old guard who utilized the dolly image to titillate and dismiss, to many young working class male, female, black and gay consumers, London's revitalized fashion scene was clearly a psychological revelation, full of tantalizing possibilities. As Sheila Rowbotham, then a young college lecturer based in Hackney, recalled, swinging London was always an external definition and regarded as a joke. But it did catch something that was happening, some process of interaction. The creative mix resulted in an alternative way to be, which was no longer simply marginal. As Jonathan Green suggests, the dolly bird was not strictly a 60s invention. The phrase had described a slattern in the 18th and 19th centuries and had referred to a pretty young girl since the early 20th. Colin McInnes identified a more recent precedent for the newly confident figure of the London dolly in his sharply observed description of the appearance of the smart working-class teenage girl of the late 50s. He says she's hatless, her hair is elfin or puffed, and probably tinctured. Her face is pallid, natural makeup with a dash of mauve or creamy rose cameo, and in either case, mascara around the eyes as if under artificial light at noon. Cotton décolleté blouse, short voluminous skirt with rattling paper petticoats, or if it's cooler, one of buttock-revealing tightness. Seamless stockings and pointed light colour shoes with stiletto heels, both very flattering to even to legs that are recalcitrant. Light hanging bag, general air from the age of 13 upwards of formidable self-possession. Now, many of the identifying features of the classic 60s dolly are included in this sketch, from the pallid makeup and heavy mascara to the provocative air of self-possession. But in some, the allure of the dolly's predecessor was of a very different order. First, the original look strove for an adult sophistication which was at odds with the infantilizing tendencies of the swinging version. The teased hair, sculptural skirts, and stiletto heels all borrowed from an idea of soigné sexuality much promoted by a generation of masquerading film and matinee stars. Secondly, the style tended towards an international register of manufactured glamour that was largely American in origin. These second-hand trends were, however, enjoying a diminishing appeal by the early years of the next decade. The success of approachable, homegrown stars like Helen Shapiro, Sandy Shaw, Dusty Springfield, all from areas of working-class areas of London, together with increased access to a new stable of British teenage magazines, including Rave, Teen Scene and Petticoat, offered young women in London and other British cities an alternative range of attainable idols. George Melly identified the London fashion model Jean Shrimpton as the prototypical dolly bird. See her here. Her distinctive yet softly unthreatening looks were highly adaptable, he says, to mass dissemination and reproduction, so that her imitators were almost interchangeable. All had long clean hair, preferably blonde, interchangeable faces, interchangeable long legs, and in their casual and interchangeable sense of beauty, their presence signalled a passively accepting attitude to easy pleasure that for Melly was vaguely unsettling. He says they represented girls as objects to an extraordinary degree. They produced a kind of generalised, rather half-hearted lust, triggered off by their ever-shortening skirts. Now, contrary to relaxed appearances, such laid-back panache was not attained without a degree of effort. The extreme metropolitan version of the dolly's toilette is boldly laid out in the Christmas 1965 edition of Mark Boxer's short-lived London Life, a title which was characterised by Booker as symptomatic of the self-regarding attitude of the era. Amidst quirky articles on children's party entertainers, futuristic moon travel, and the Autonesque love letters of a Brixton prisoner, are two articles foregrounding the increasingly stylized adornment of the dolly's body, the illustration of one we see here. A fashion shoot extolled readers to spoil yourself at least once a year, and in this, a model sporting a platinum blonde wig sprawls voluptuously across soft sheepskin in anticipation of Roger Vadim's 1968 heroine, Barbarella. She's dressed in variations of white jersey, and in other shoots, glittering crochet, costume jewels and fur, all sourced from London shops. And representations such as these sagged seamlessly with the eroticised environment of Chelsea and Kensington, ensuring that the Dolly Bird was implicated in a broader consumerist mise-en-scène which held deeply subversive ramifications. Marianne Faithfull gave voice to what Angela Carter has described as the inexpressible decadence of the 60s in her evocation of this sensual, enticing, but illusory landscape. She talked about Harrods looming up like a great liner, Walton Street with dozens of seductive boutiques, shop windows filled with bright, smarty colours, miniskirts, sequin gowns, slinky thigh boots, brass earrings. It fades out. Subsequent post-feminist readings of the Dolly scenario point up its glaring paradoxes. In her work on the single girl, Hilary Radner indicates that though this ideal prioritised the positive characteristics of youthful energy, emotional independence, economic self-sufficiency, and especially unfettered mobility, the extent to which such freedoms came under the control of young women themselves is, of course, debatable. Representations of the single girl, particularly those expressed through the newly kinetic medium of fashion photography, seem to Radner to have limited the capacity of young women to break through established constraints, especially those set up by capitalist institutions. As she argues, both in appearance, waif-like and adolescent, and in goals to be glamorous and adored by men while economically independent, the single girl defines femininity outside a traditional patriarchal construction. At the same time, she establishes consumerism as the mechanism that replaces maternity in the construction of the feminine. So the Dolly Bird, to finish with her borrowed finery and faux innocence, epitomised that diffuse 60s concept of the look, a notion which Radner suggests tended to undermine a concrete definition of style as ownership, something achieved through assembling a set of objects. The look also emphasised the element of surprise, of the unanticipated, of the continually new, as an attribute of the stylish. And crucially, the Dolly's look was capable of cutting across the social and class constituencies which still marked London's new style meritocracy. Thus, on the television show Ready, Steady, Go, the singer Dusty Springfield could survey the studio audience and, peering through her panda eyes, discover that a fan wearing the same off-the-peg Marks and Spencer's dress as herself was a cause for celebration. Similarly, Carol Denny, the proprietor of a boutique in the King's Road, could boast unreservedly that our biggest regular source of regular customers are the Dolly Birds, which, to be slightly snobbish about it, means working class girls. It must be at least half their wages going on clothes. This revelation was also a sign of changing times and priorities, betraying the extent to which the Dolly Bird or the Chelsea girl, like the girl of the period and the flapper before and the It girl and the Essex girl afterwards, had become a ubiquitous cipher for the pleasures and perils of consumerism, and every girl for the all-conquering culture of the commodity. For as Jonathan Aitken commented, Dolly Birds may economise on their lunchtime eating habits to do it, debutantes may borrow, factory girls may work extra overtime. The point is, they're all doing it. Now, I don't want to end with an Aitken quote. That's got quite a bizarre authority on which to end. So I turn instead back to Matthew Hilton, whose challenge I dodged at the outset. And I reiterate it here while the spectre of the Dolly remains in full focus. He says, if it is true, as numerous cultural critics attest, that we define ourselves today not through the labour we engage in, but through the commodities we consume, then it is only to be expected that the politics of consumption will continue to act as the fulcrum around which citizenship is defined and as the site through which political action takes place. I hope I've given some ground to the notion that the Dolly Bird might well play a part in those debates. Thank you very much.